and the temperatures dropped. I think day seven, you know, the second half was a cold snap, but day seven was the coldest and it got to about 20 below ambient temperature. It was pretty still, but any breeze then was just, you know, cuts you that much more.
Hey folks, I'm your host, Mason Gravely. Welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. Today we're talking to a veteran of the podcast, and that is Brandon Joy. He was on the show back in, what was it, episode 687. He was climbing the highest peaks in Montana, the 50 highest peaks, all in one trip, which was wild. Literally piecing together 50 different mountains, all on foot, all in one big effort. It was wild. Go back and listen to that episode to get another sense of how crazy Brandon's trips are. But this most recent one is wild. It was over the winter. It was a handful of months ago, right at the peak of winter. And if you know anything about Yellowstone and Grand Teton, where this trip took place, oh my gosh, it can get so cold there in the winter. It is brutal. It is winter there. Well after it should be winter, if you know what I mean. Like, it is just freezing there so much of the time. And so when I heard Brandon crossed it on foot, solo, in the middle of winter, I was absolutely mind blown. The most miraculous thing is he didn't die, because that would have been the first thing that happened to me. I would have just shriveled and withered away and frozen to death, because I don't handle the cold well. So something that Brandon actually talks a lot about in this episode is just what gear he brought on this trip. You know, gear is what makes trips possible. You can't just cross Yellowstone on foot without anything. You need specialized gear. You need the right equipment. But that doesn't mean that gear has to be brand new out of the box and the price of a home to actually get. I'm a huge fan of used gear. Buying and selling used gear is one of the greatest ways to make your adventure more possible. How many of us are letting gear or letting the lack of it keep us from doing our adventures because it's so expensive, or maybe you're looking for this one thing? Well, I would really encourage you to check out rerouted.co. They have so many things, a huge selection of all sorts of one-of-a-kind items, as well as very specialty items, things for more general use, like just camping in general. You know, it's a great way to start and try something out, and Rerouted is a great way to get some of that gear, to try some of those new sports, to see if you really like them before you start investing more into them. A lot of positives to buying and selling used gear. One, keep stuff out of landfills. Two, saves you a lot of money. Three, it's one of a kind. And four, it just makes adventure more possible because you're not blowing all your money on gear. So if you're on the lookout for something that you need for your next adventure, please check out rerouted.co. All right, let's get into the episode. All right, folks, welcome to the podcast. You see by the title, we've got an alumni of ASP coming back, Brandon Joy, here to tell us about his most recent adventure. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mason. It's great to be back.
But man, how are you feeling? And also, I always ask this first, where are you coming from?
So I'm in the Sun Valley area for a few days. Kind of came here after the trip, and I've just been relaxing, you know, again, taking a little bit of time off work and, you know, just trying to. My main focus after these trips is, you know, it sounds maybe pretty basic or obvious, but to just really focus on hydration, eating as much as I can possibly eat, and sleep, because those are really the things that are going to help me bounce back faster.
Man, that sounds also, like the life right there.
Yeah.
Drink, eat, and sleep, man. Just what a, that's what my dog's been doing that for 10 years. So I don't know what he's trained for, but he's doing a great job.
Yeah. And it's, to be honest, it's surprisingly difficult for me. Cause like after these trips, it's a hard effort. It's strenuous, like physically and mentally. And I just kind of want to let loose and just relax and like, just do whatever, stay up late or, you know, have a few beers. But ultimately, you know, I still need to just keep in the back of my mind to just, keep the Nalgene filled with water, you know, just not setting an alarm, just sleeping in and being cognizant of how I'm doing, and also taking time, appropriate time, to reflect on what just happened. Cause as you know, with longer trips or, intense trips, you're out there and it can sometimes feel like it's dragging, but then it's like you snap your fingers or you blink your eyes, and then all of a sudden you're back in civilization and there's cars swarming around you, and you're like, whoa, it just goes by so fast.
It really does, man. And especially for a trip like this, that's so isolating. And I'm sure, this is something that at least I notice when I'm out in like snow covered areas, it's so quiet all the time. You know what I mean? It's that muffled, everything's muffled from the snow. And so you had this incredibly isolated experience and probably incredibly quiet experience. And now you're back in normal life. Tell us about what you did. Like, what did you do? How would you summarize it to someone that you just met?
So I essentially wanted to go on a long distance ski tour that was remote, and I would get to see places and experience things that I couldn't necessarily do otherwise with just a weekend trip. So I created a route, which is funny. This idea came to fruition right before I went out on my Beartooth trip to do the Montana Top 50, like the end of July. I was routing this, and I remember thinking, because I was in Gaia mapping my Beartooth route, and I was thinking, oh man, I should really focus on the Beartooth route and not get distracted about some other trips going on when I'm leaving for the Beartooth in a week. But it wasn't something I knew I was going to do, but it was something that was interesting, was the idea of just kind of crossing Yellowstone National Park. And the idea developed some more, and mostly because of snow conditions in the northern end of the park, it's a lot drier. So I would have had to fight some, bare ground and that kind of thing. So I started at the base of the Grand Teton, and Grand Teton National Park. I traversed north across the park and then into Yellowstone, and essentially ended in West Yellowstone. So the route ended up being roughly 110 miles and took 9 days, which I did solo. And I'll say I went in with the intention of doing it unsupported, no caches. I built a small sled with, kind of a basic toboggan that you can buy from, Ace Hardware REI for $40, and then put a couple half-inch PVC poles and carabiners, and just was able to attach that to the hip belt of my backpack and just drag it along behind me.
Oh my gosh, man. I'm looking at the map of it. You literally, it's like, not necessarily along the road, but you went through some of the most iconic places in Yellowstone and in the Tetons, starting at the base of the Teton, crossing Yellowstone Lake, crossing Jackson Lake first, then Yellowstone Lake, which I assume because they were frozen, and you're carrying all your stuff. You didn't resupply at all through your entire traverse of Grand Teton and Yellowstone.
That's correct. And I'll make a slight correction. So the map that you are looking at was my intended route before I started. When I was actually out there, once I crossed into Yellowstone, I was already far behind schedule. And so I had to reroute. The last 6 days of the trip were impromptu, kind of decide as you go on a day by day basis where to go. The late travel, I thought would, because you're thinking it's flat and it's probably wind scoured. You might get some crust skiing. The lakes, I ended up crossing 6 lakes in total. And they ended up, a couple of them were actually pretty good for travel. And then a couple of them ended up being incredibly arduous. One of them was right off the bat was Jackson Lake. And you know, it's only about 10 miles long, and it took me roughly 2 days to cross. I mean, it was really challenging for a couple reasons. And I talked to a couple park rangers before I left, and one of them has done a lot of ski touring in the park. He's worked in the park for 20 years, super knowledgeable. And he warned me of the lake slush that can sort of slow travel down. And I don't know if to call it a phenomenon, but it's just, it occurs when you get snow loading, and the lakes are all completely frozen. You get snow loading on top. And then I was actually geeking out on this a little bit the other day. Newton's third law, every force has an equal and opposite reaction. So when the frozen lens on top of the lake, it has a weight distribution, it pushes down and actually forces on mostly on the peripherals of the lake. It forces the ice down, and then water from fresh water comes up, and then we'll say it kind of floods the lake. And so when I was crossing Jackson Lake, there were portions of time where there was a foot of snow on top, which I was completely sinking down in because it was fresh. And then there was a foot of slush underneath. I mean, pure slush. And so, you know, I'll circle back a little bit. The trip ended up being, I wanted to do this in like the dead of winter and experience the kind of the fierce cold or climate that might come of it. The more logical thing to do would be wait till late spring, say in about a month or so, end of March, when the snow is more consolidated. They haven't been getting big snowstorms, snow accumulations, and then you stay on the surface a lot more and you can make ground a lot easier. What ended up happening is the whole Jackson area and, you know, Grand Teton National Park area had in the top five snowiest Februarys on record, which means that the 2 weeks prior to me starting, it got tons of snow. And then in the first 72 hours, there were like two 24-hour storms that each yielded about a foot of snow. So it was just coming down. And then that Jackson Lake, you know, I was crossing day two and three, since it had gotten roughly 2 feet of snow. That's a ton of snow loading. And then there was a ton of water on the lake itself. Then as I moved into the park, and then I got more snow as I moved into the park. And then the second half of the trip, there was a cold snap. So if it had warmed up, and the sun was out, it would have given the snow a chance to consolidate some. But instead, I just got all of the snow, and then it just didn't really budge. So I had to just trudge through all that fresh snow and then what had accumulated sort of in the first half of February through the trip as well. And I had an alpine touring setup, which is also not the most ideal setup for this trip. So, you know, just looks like a standard pair of alpine skis that you'd see someone skiing in, boots that you'd see someone in a resort ski with. And I ski at a resort with the same setup, but my heels can detach. And, you know, so then you're just locked in at your toe and you can hike around. Similar concept to snowshoes. And then I have skins, which are one side is sticky that goes on the bottom of your ski. And then the other side that faces the snow is sort of has the same concept. I think of like a seal skin, where if you pet it one way, it's soft. And then if you pet it, you know, if you run your hand the other direction, it's all the hair stands up and it's more abrasive. So that allows you to have traction in the snow. But when those skins get wet or you have temperatures that are above freezing, you get the water molecules, liquid, that get into the skins, and then you get snow glop. So you actually, as you're walking around, you're getting these the entire base of your ski. Not only do you have your boots on your feet and your skis and the skins, but then you also have like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 inches of this constantly adjusting snow load that's just stuck to your skins. And you can, you know, take your skis off and scrape it off, but because of the conditions and you still have the some fluid water on in the skins, as soon as you start going again, you have snowglop immediately. So I was really struggling with that on Jackson Lake. And I was also each step, because of the fresh snow, it was light. I was in my ski boot with my skis on, like every step almost I was, we'll say, post-holing, and the snow was coming up to the top of my ski boot.
And this is right at the beginning. What were you thinking at that point in the trip about the way you had planned or the way you were going to go? I mean, was it starting to get questionable even that early on?
I mean, yes. You know, I had planned essentially after, I thought it would take 2 days to traverse Grand Teton National Park. And I think it ended up taking about 3.5. And so I think it was after the second day into the third day, you know, I was planning to do roughly, say, 13 miles a day. And days 2 and 3, I think I averaged 7 miles a day, which ended up also being my hardest days. I mean, these were long, you know, averaging less than a mile per hour, really slow days. And at that point, I knew that I had to change my route. Because if Jackson Lake's only 10 miles long and it put me through the ringer, Yellowstone Lake is 20 miles long and it's way more exposed. It's a lot wider. I mean, in portions, it's as wide as Jackson Lake is long. And that route also ended up, you know, if I would have gone to Yellowstone Lake, would have also had a lot more elevation gain. Another thing I found out is that especially in the deep powder, any type of elevation gain, my sled at the start weighed about 60 pounds and half of that was food. And any type of elevation gain was just, it was just so difficult. And so I just knew that I had to kind of cut the route short, and I still wanted to make the most of it. So I just kind of cut out Yellowstone Lake and rerouted accordingly.
There's very few roads out there. There's really just a couple. Did you see anybody, or were you pretty isolated most of the time?
So Yellowstone National Park is basically closed. Like, they don't plow any of the roads in the winter. They don't even try. But the main highways that go through Yellowstone, they groom. And so they have a groomer that comes by like once a day, and I think most of the roads. And there are a lot of people that go in and they do snowmobile tours. So from the south entrance or from West Yellowstone, they'll snowmobile in, or there's also snow coaches. So they have these, I mean, they look like a standard bus, small bus, not even bus, like minivan almost, but they put these giant wheels and tires on. So they have this mass, and I mean, they look like tanks, and they just drive on the road, no problem. But they since they groom the roads every day, it ended up being a lot faster travel. And I knew before I started the trip, I didn't know what the snow conditions were going to be like. You know, I can hear that, yeah, there's been a ton of snow, but in February, but there wasn't a lot of snow before that. And so I didn't really have a good perception of what the level of effort was to post hole around, drag the sled in deep snow. And so I knew that the roads were a good fallback, I guess is what I'm saying. And I ended up taking the roads for, I think, roughly a third of the duration. And that was almost entirely in Yellowstone Park. And so people would go by, there are, you know, big groups in the morning, and then later in the afternoon, as people just go into Old Faithful, there's a couple pull-offs along the way where there's some cool water features or waterfalls or good views that they'd pull off at, and they'd keep on rolling. So I ended up seeing a lot of people, but I was just chugging. When I did, I was just chugging along the road, and they were just kind of zooming around, and there wasn't a lot of human interaction. The entire trip, I never saw anyone else that was on, you know, foot travel. It was just people that were utilizing the roads for sightseeing purposes.
Jeez, man. So tell us about, you know, you mentioned the post-holing through the snow, and that obviously is just making life very difficult for you early on. What were some of the other challenges of doing this versus your Montana's highest 50 peaks adventure? Obviously, there's the temperature, which would be probably my biggest deterring factor, is how cold it was. But how hard was that to actually deal with, and what were some of those challenges?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would agree. The first thing is really just the temperature. And, you know, in the Beartooth trip, it was really easy to, in some sense, to see where I was going, because the beauty of it being a high route and doing a bunch of peaks is that you always have, almost always have a good vantage point. Whereas with this trip, I was primarily navigating with compass, and especially on the lake crossings, for example, crossing Jackson Lake, it might have been upwards of it was fully socked in, you know, 3/4 of the time I was on that lake for 2 days. And there were portions of time where it was a full whiteout. You know, I could be half a mile from shore on the west end, and all I could see was white. The lake is flat and white, clouds are socked in, and it's just dumping snow. Like, I couldn't see. I mean, and it's kind of a visual sensory deprivation. And I had this little Suunto compass that I clipped onto my watch, you know, wristband. So I just kind of pull my, it was kind of nice because I was going due north. So I would just like look at that every once in a while and just try and stay in a straight trajectory. But it was really disorienting. At some points, there'd be a little bit of cloud break, we'll say. And I could see shore for a little bit. And then I'm squinting and trying to figure out and get context for what I'm looking at. And the lake crossing itself was just a huge mental game. I mean, 2 days on the lake of just going straight and nothing really changing, nothing really getting any closer. It just felt like I was going so slow that it was mentally pretty taxing just to trudge forward and go straight. And then the cold was another factor. I mean, the Beartooth trip was the lowest it got was about freezing. And this trip, I don't think it ever got above freezing. And the temperatures dropped, I think, day 7 or so. The second half was a cold snap, but day 7 was the coldest, and it got to about 20 below ambient temperature. It was pretty still, but any breeze then was just, you know, cuts you that much more. And so I had like 4 different pairs of gloves of, varying degree of, we'll call it insulation or warmth. My sleeping bag was rated to negative 40. I have a good small 2-person mountaineering tent. And that stuff worked great. But things I haven't experienced before are, because it was always sub-freezing, I ended up getting some moisture and condensation issues in my tent and in and on the outside of my sleeping bag. So especially the second half of the trip, you know, it's like anytime I'm getting in or out of my tent, you know, it's snowing, or it's just impossible to keep snow out. I try, but it's just impossible. My sleeping bag, when I lay it out, you know, when I'm taking off my ski boots at the end of the night, I sit on my sleeping bag. Well, any snow that's on there or anything or any moisture that might be on my pants then just melts it onto my sleeping bag. Or when I sleep, I'm on one side of the tent, my gear is on the other side, you know, my body is radiating heat. And so because there was condensation and frost build up on the interior of my tent, then that was melting onto my sleeping bag. So the last like 4 nights, I think I just my feet were numb the entire night. Even though some of those nights it got down to only 0 degrees and my bag is rated for negative 40, because there was this ice lens on my sleeping bag that I couldn't dry out, my feet were just numb. And those were things that are not only different from the Beartooth trip, but I just didn't anticipate. it got, and I also have a good little, I used an MSR Whisper Light stove, which is a classic, you know, it's a creme de la creme of stoves that people take into cold regions. And it runs, I mean, you can pretty much run off of, you can run off of a handful of different types of fuel. The main fuel that's utilized is white gas, and it runs. But there is a point where the fuel bottle has a gasket and you put a fuel pump and screw it on the top. Well, that if it's, I think it's really around negative 10 or negative 15, that gasket, you know, molecularly shrinks, and then you can't get a good seal, and then you can't pressurize your fuel canister. When you can't pressurize your fuel canister, you can't work your stove. And so there, that really cold morning, I got up and I just couldn't even get my stove going, you know, and I tried for a while, I couldn't get it pressurized. And so after all that time, after the really cold night, and I'm just standing around and it's 20 below, I couldn't even get something warm to drink or melt any snow. And I had to melt snow the entire time. I didn't bring an auger or anything to penetrate the ice, because that's really the only predictable fresh water that I could have gotten. So the entirety of the trip, I just had to melt snow. And in the morning and in the evening, I think it was about a 2-hour time frame that I was just melting snow. It's the first thing I did right when I got up is turn on the stove, start melting snow. And it was the first thing I did when I got to camp. So I'd start melting snow, and then I'd have to dig a pit for my tent. Otherwise, you know, when you get in your tent, you just sink down. Like the first couple nights, there's 5, maybe 6 feet of snow, you know, from surface to the ground. So I had to dig a pit that was the surface area, the footing of my tent, plus a bit extra at the entrance to allow me to get in and out. And it had to be at least 3 feet deep to where when I got in, I wouldn't just continue to sink down. And that in and of itself was, I mean, it took me 30 minutes of solid, rigorous shoveling to dig the pits. And I ran some calculations yesterday, continuing the geeking out trend. Maybe it's the engineer in me, but it, you know, roughly 1,000 pounds of snow to dig out that pit each night.
Jeez.
So those, I mean, so it's not just like, you know, ski all day and get to camp and you just have a hunky dory time. It's like you ski, you wake up, you're put on my cold ski boots, my feet immediately go numb if they're not already numb, and then continue to like melt snow, fill up my capacity, try and hydrate, eat, organize my food for the day, and then ski all day. And then it's that whole like camp setup situation. So those are probably the main differences that I had between, you know, I guess in terms of climate, between the Beartooth trip and this.
Was there anything out there or any experiences or daily habits that brought you joy, that brought you something to look forward to?
Oh yeah. I mean, it was, I honestly really enjoy the isolation. There's something, and I was thinking about this morning, like whether it's Yellowstone or somewhere else, just being out in the wilderness and especially off trail and just deciding where you want to go is beyond liberating. And just going places that people don't really go, you know, especially for this in the winter. Like I saw so many things that were unexpected, you know, wildlife. I didn't know what I was going to see or where I was going to see it, and sunrise and sunset and all of these, the natural processes of the world, like even the lake slush. Like I don't want to explain that and have it sound like the trip was just this big suffer fest. I mean, I'm fascinated.
So far, that's what it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just fascinated by the process of the natural world and how things really work. And had I not gone out, I wouldn't have known that lake slush was something that happened. And I learned a lot about the park. There was a giant fire in the park in 1988 that burned roughly a third of the park, which is 2 million acres. And as a result, sort of the trees and foliage of the park has changed, and it bounced back, but in a different way. And some areas just had really like unnavigable, dense lodgepole forests. And I got to see some of those and experience that. And I think that it's just, it gives me a context for this world that I would have never otherwise seen. And it's in winter, like you mentioned, it's dead silent. And that in and of itself is just something that we don't really get to experience in the day-to-day life.
Sounds magical, honestly, when you put it in that sense. What was the situation with the animals? Because that's one of the things that Yellowstone's really known for, is the wildlife. What is going on that time of year with the wildlife?
Yeah, that was something that I mean, one of the reasons why I picked Yellowstone in particular is because it's Jurassic Park. I mean, there's free roaming bison, you know, there's moose and elk and wolves. I mean, there's mountain lions, there's all of the big game critters and so much more that take refuge there. And I had no idea what I was going to see. Interestingly, the first 3 days crossing Grand Teton National Park, like in the entirety of 3 days, I only saw two raptors, two birds flying around on separate occasions. Total. I think I saw maybe one or two sets of animal tracks. And I was just thinking, where are all the animals? And as I started, you know, as I continued north, I started to realize like there was less snow. And then I realized that there was a lot more animal tracks, and I saw a lot more animal activity, and I saw a lot more animals. But just in those 3 days, I was laughing to myself, thinking like, geez, I see a significant more wildlife driving to Walmart where I live, a couple miles from my house, than I did crossing this national park. I mean, at least I probably see a deer and a domestic dog, right? But this was just two birds. And then the last couple days, really, I mean, and for perspective too, as I mentioned, the Grand Teton National Park could have somewhere in the realm of like 5 to 6 feet of snow right now. West Yellowstone has about 3 feet. And in the middle of the park near Old Faithful, and then to West Yellowstone, there's a lot of thermal activity. So the snow in those areas is a lot less, has a lot less depth. And that's where I started to see all of the bison, because they're grazing. And they essentially put their head down in the snow and move the snow out of the way so they can get to the vegetation below. And I saw hundreds and hundreds of bison. I saw a fox, like a red fox, one night. I think it was my last night out there. And at dusk, it was in this kind of flat area ahead of me. And I just watched it hunt for like 30 minutes. I was just in awe. And for some reason too, just another thing I observed within myself and in the day-to-day life, as I'm driving around, you know, I could be driving to a job or just going somewhere for the weekend. When I see wildlife along the side of the road or a bird flying by, you know, and this maybe it's just me, but I'm like, oh, you know, I acknowledge it. That's cool. But I'm also driving 70 miles an hour. And as soon as you see it, it's gone. And doing these types of trips really gives me time to slow down. And as I mentioned, observe the natural world. And I just got the fox was just walking around, and then it would point on something, and then it would kind of rear up and then just jump vertically and pounce down into the snow, you know, head first in attempt to get some mouse or vole or some small critter that's down there. And when I watched it hunt, it was unsuccessful. But it just kept wandering around. The last day I saw two coyotes, and one of them, you know, was going along the road as I was in the, you know, opposing direction, but then there was some traffic on the road and it went off the side and it was just deep. This was a lone coyote, and it was just this deep post hole lane up this steep, I don't even know what you'd call it, just this probably 100 vertical feet, kind of this rock feature. And I just watched it struggle up that. And it gave me perspective too for sort of what, I mean, I'm out there for 9 days and I come back and I'm, you know, licking my wounds, but these animals are out there 365 days a year, and they manage and they find food and shelter and endure all of these temperatures. And the bison honestly seemed relatively unaffected by the cold temperatures. You know, they'd lay down and then in the morning I'd see them and they're up and they're just walking around eating.
So crazy, man. Gosh.
Yeah. I saw an eagle on the last day. There's quite a few ducks, you know, floating in the river. There were a few rivers that were not frozen. And I think mostly because of two reasons. One, because of the thermal activity that feeds into the rivers. And two, because there's enough water that the water's moving and it's more difficult to freeze. One of those rivers is the Madison River that I was adjacent to, you know, the last day. I did a long, hard push, bit over 20 miles to get out. And there were trumpeter swans, you know, big white birds that were just in the river floating around, and ducks. I saw geese. I mean, so it was for the first 3 days having kind of an absence of all life. Coming towards the end of the trip, where it just seemed to be all around me, was kind of a magical turnaround.
That is too cool. That is what a great way to finish the trip too. Another aspect of Yellowstone I wanted to ask you about was, you know, Yellowstone's famous for its, you know, thermal activity. Like you said, if you've never been on the surface, it just looks like some outdoor space, you know, incredibly beautiful, and there's animals, but there's just this bizarreness to the landscape with all the activity going on. You'll just be walking around, and there's this gurgling, bubbling pool of mud 30 feet across, just out in the woods. There's not even a marker, nothing around it. It's just like, what the hell is going on? It's like a Dr. Seuss landscape sometimes. Did you experience anything like that? Because another thing about Yellowstone is, so as many people that visit it, there's so much of it that's still uncharted, still unknown. There's famously like 300 waterfalls that were discovered from very little effort back in the early 2000s, just because it was just enough off the beaten path. No one had ever visited or documented it. You taking a lot of time off roads and stuff, did you see anything like that that really was odd or struck you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say too that coming in the winter is also a different aspect. And, you know, it kind of goes without saying, but with the summer, I mean, the thermal features are still bubbling and fuming. And, you know, I went through Old Faithful area and there's just tons of thermal activity. I mean, when I went through there, it was probably 15 degrees and the wind was blowing and there's, it was snowing heavily at times, but you could just see through through the mist of white that was all over the landscape. You could just see the vapor coming out of the earth. And then even when I got off the beaten path, and I was just doing some off-road miles, there are still a lot of thermal features that just don't have names. They're just there. And I didn't know that they'd be there. And some of them are very colorful. And I know I've heard that I haven't been to Old Faithful area in the summer, but I've heard in the summer they actually have quite a bit more color. But just like you're saying, just like mud, and it's like, how is it? It's like 10 below zero. And these areas are just hot still. Probably the coolest thing I saw the entire trip was something I also didn't expect. The second to last day, you know, by the end of the trip, I was pretty tired. And I could have just taken the last 2 days, I could have taken like, you know, 15 miles a day on the road. And it would have been pretty low key to get out. But the second to last day, you know, when I was in Old Faithful, I stopped and was talking with the ranger, and he suggested going off the road to this other area, Fairy Meadows, Lower Geyser Basin, and then Fairy Falls. And I was, you know, kind of tossing and turning on it, just like, ah, is it worth it? And it's been really cold. You know, do I have the energy to do this? And then I knew that if I did that, chances are my last day would be a solid 20 miles to get out. But I thought, you know, I'll just go for it. So I did. And Fairy Falls was an out and back. It's the only time that I actually was able to ski around without my sled or backpack. It was just 3 miles round trip. And I'd seen a lot of water features, a lot of small waterfalls, but this was unlike any waterfall I'd seen in my life. And I think because of the unique conditions of it being a little bit warmer with the snow, the rivers were kind of pumping at a higher flow rate than usual. And then the cold snap happened. And I was at this waterfall a couple days. Well, I guess it had been really cold for, say, roughly 36 hours. And I think it gave this waterfall that already had a lot of ice this opportunity to just freeze in this unworldly way. And it was just, I honestly don't even really know how to describe it other than it literally looked like a cathedral of ice. And in the cathedral, you know, it was probably 200 feet tall. At the top, there was this inverted cone that was probably 20 feet long that water was gushing out down into. And it was just, I mean, it was probably only a few inches thick, but it was massive. And then it gushed down into the cathedral, which was had a hole in it that was 360 degrees, full encapsulating blue ice. And then it rushed down, and then there was this big opening where the water was just gushing and hitting rock. And on all, you know, the ice feature itself, that cathedral's at points probably 70, 80 feet wide. And I just stood there, and I was just, I kind of took my breath away. And then near the thermal features themselves, because of the vapor, you know, and that's going through the air, and it can be kind of windy, it gets pushed into the nearby, you know, if there's any exposed vegetation or saplings or trees, and you get these frost conditions on the trees that are remarkable on this. And so that also on this Fairy Falls day, I went by this thermal feature called Ojo Caliente. And nearby there was a downfall tree with its, you know, these roots exposed. And there was almost what I would consider two-dimensional ice where you could see the different layers. I mean, it was ice that was protruding from these roots, you know, horizontally. And really didn't have any thickness. And I was just completely in awe. And there were small, along the entire route, you know, we'll call them holes near boulders or trees. There's like gaps where the snow hadn't quite filled in. And I don't know what causes this, but I saw in these, and I'd stop and like peek in these holes, they're like little caverns. And there were just massive ice crystals. And I mean, some of them, and they took all kinds of forms. You know, I would think it would be just a big cluster, but it took the form of, some of them look like leaves. And they're, you know, 5 centimeters long, like 2 inches long.
Jeez.
And I just, so all of these things are just out of this world that, again, I'm sure that they exist in other places, but going out in the winter in these isolated regions gave me the opportunity to just explore and see whatever it was that was meant to be.
Gosh, man, beautifully said. I'm looking at the pictures that you sent, Fairy Falls, and just the different aspects of the ice, and just it's unreal. It looks like just another planet you were exploring. It had to be such a strange experience at times, a beautiful experience, and so rewarding. I hate to run, but I got a hard stop on the hour. Can you share with us maybe the biggest lesson you learned with this experience, keeping your previous 50 peaks kind of in mind, like versus what you learned on that? What did you learn here, and what is next for you? What do you think? I know it's fresh, but is there anything clicking around? You said this idea was coming, you know, before your last trip. So do you already have what you want to do next in mind?
As far as what I've learned, I think that this trip reinforced what the Beartooth trip illustrated. And that is for me to continue getting off the beaten path and in exploring wild places. I just feel it's so rewarding to push myself wherever I am for extended periods and to really try to understand the natural world around me. And it makes me feel, it's invigorating, and it makes me feel more connected with everything around me, having a deeper understanding. And it's something that I just want to continue to expand on. This trip in particular was something that I had been thinking about for, as I mentioned, the last 6 months or so. But this is, and so I wanted to do this, but it's also a building block for the future. I'm trying to develop and cultivate skills that would allow me to do longer trips or maybe more challenging terrain, get more accustomed with the different type of gear. And just get more honed in with that. So I have two other things I've planned for this year that are also, I see them as their expeditions on their own, but they're also just great opportunities for me to learn. The first one is, and it's kind of dependent on the snowpack, but I want to come back to Wyoming in July and do all of the 13ers. They're 36 or 37 of them, similar to the Beartooth, the Montana top 50, but instead just go do this same thing in Wyoming. And immediately following that, a buddy and I are flying to Kyrgyzstan to attempt a climb on Lenin Peak, which is roughly the 100th tallest mountain in the world. And it sits at about 23,500 feet. And so getting more accustomed with, just continuing to develop the climbing, the endurance, the cold winter camping, getting more affiliated with the stove and different conditions that make travel easier or harder, risk mitigation and management. Those are all things that I am just going to continue to expand on with these two trips in July and August.
Brandon, I am very excited for you, for what's coming up, for your, continuing down this road. You know, you're saying it, I feel like in a lot of ways you're just beginning, but that Wyoming trip is going to be wild. I've got one other friend that's doing something similar this summer with 100 peaks, but news about that will come out soon, and we'll absolutely have him on the show to talk about it. And of course, anything you ever do, we're more than happy to discuss, but man, what a joy to, it's your last name, but what a joy, Brandon, to talk to you again and hear about this and see some of this, visualize this landscape. What a fascinating trip. Well, cool. Was there anything else you wanted to share where folks could follow you?
I'm currently writing a trip report, and I'm including probably more photos than people would want to see as part of that visual.
They're really good.
Description and representation of the trip. But my Instagram is the Wild Ned, with underscores between the words, and that would probably be the best place to catch up with me and to see photos from this trip and what's coming next.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to the show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.